All righty. We're looking at the book of Exodus. We asked ourselves last week, why in the world were we studying an Old Testament book when we've got at least 21 epistles, New Testament books, from which we get our instruction for life? Why are we looking at an Old Testament book? And we gave two good answers, we think, two answers that I believe are good. The first one was, all Scripture is profitable, right? 2 Timothy 3:16, God has given us all Scripture that we have, and it's all profitable. So there's never any reason not to study any particular book, and so that's one reason. But a second and a little more specific reason we cited was that the Old Testament books, especially the Pentateuch, illustrate the New Testament principles and doctrines. Remember, we cited Abraham as Paul's illustration of the doctrine of justification by faith. Remember that? Where's Abraham's life given to us? In the Old Testament, right? Sure. So the Old Testament illustrates the New. So we study the Old Testament to better understand our New Testament doctrines and principles. And so that's why we're studying this book. The book of Exodus is replete with illustrations of New Testament doctrines and principles. And let's review for just a second before we go on the organization of our Bible to see where this book fits. Your English Bible is organized into 5 books, 17 books, and 17 more books. The first 5 are the Pentateuch, or the Law, or the Torah. It goes by all those names. Those 5 books, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, those 5 books reveal a theology that's very much parallel with the theology you get in the epistles, Romans through Jude. So you have those 5 books. Then we have the next 17, which are called the writings, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 1 Samuel, 2 Kings, 1 Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Song of Solomon. Those 17 are the next ones in your English Bible. And the last 17 are the prophets. 4 biggies, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel. Jeremiah wrote 2 books, so there's 5 books. 4 prophets, but 5 books. And then there's 12 minor prophets. Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. 5, the Pentateuch. 17, the writings. 17, the prophets. That's your English Old Testament in terms of its organization. Our book is in those first 5, the Pentateuch. And that doctrine contained in those 5 is very parallel to and similar to the doctrine we get in our epistles. So as we're going through Exodus this time, we're going to be looking for and emphasizing the various illustrations we find here to our New Testament doctrines and principles. There's other ways to approach the book, but that's the approach I'm going to take this time, to just try to illustrate as much as we can our New Testament doctrines. Hopefully we'll understand them a little better as a result of looking at all these different illustrations. Now, last week we began at the beginning in chapter 1, where we see the setting of the book. And in chapter 1, we saw 3 of our New Testament doctrines and principles illustrated in just chapter 1. Remember what those were? The doctrine of election is illustrated. God selected one family from one guy and his descendants to be the recipients of his blessings and of his covenanted relationships. Of all the families on the earth, he picked just this one. His name was Jacob, and all of his descendants are in that family. So we saw the doctrine of election illustrated there for us. We talked about that a bit. We saw the principle of growth through suffering, which is a New Testament principle. A number of our New Testament writers talk about that. We saw that illustrated because that nation that God picked, that elected peoples, were persecuted. They suffered. The Egyptians turned on them and tried to cause them to suffer, didn't they? But did it work? No, they grew from 70 to about 2 million. So suffering did not destroy them at all. It actually caused them to grow and do well, in spite of the fact that Pharaoh tried enslaving them. That didn't work. He tried infanticide. That didn't work. He tried genocide. That didn't work. And they still just kept growing and growing and getting bigger and stronger and better. And so growth through suffering, our New Testament principle is illustrated also in chapter 1. And the third illustration we saw was that of obey God rather than men if there's a conflict between the two. Acts chapter 4 and 5, Peter teaches us that in the New Testament. And we see it illustrated here in the Old by these, what shall we call them, nurses? Midwives, I guess they were, that delivered the infants. Pharaoh told them, take those infants, if they're males, and chuck them in the Nile. Let them be crocodile bait. And the midwife said, no, we fear God more than you. And so they did not do that. And God blessed them as a result of that, and they got families of their own. So those three doctrines that we learn in our New Testament studies are illustrated here in the Old. And we'll see more and more of those as we go along. All right, chapter 2 is where we want to continue on here this morning. Moses' life, fortunately for those of us whose memories are slipping pretty badly, is divided quite nicely into three units of 40 years each. That's pretty easy to remember, isn't it? 40 years, 40 years, and 40 years. That's the way his life unfolds in Scripture. And so when we get to chapter 2, we'll see the first of those 40 years in his life. And there is another important New Testament doctrine that we will see illustrated here as we go through this particular section of the book. You ever heard the term divine providence? Can you find that word in your New Testament Bible, in your English Bible? No, you can't find that word. There is no word for providence in the Scriptures. But the concept is there. The wording is not, but the concept is there. What's the concept of Romans 8:28? All things work together for good to those that love God, those that are the called according to his purpose. All things work together for good. And as we look at Moses' life here, we're going to see an illustration of that. Watch for the detail that we see unfold here as a result of God's providential care of Moses and his life. Verse 1 of chapter 2, now a man from the house of Levi went and married a daughter of Levi. Where does God's providential care of Moses begin? With his parents. It goes back a generation before he's even alive, isn't it? This is a marriage that God has providentially put together to produce this man, Moses. He didn't know anything about it. He ain't even born yet. And this couple has married. They've already got two children that we'll find out a little bit more about later. One is a daughter. She's about 15 or so at this time. Her name is Miriam. And the other is a son. He's 3. And his name is Aaron. And so God's providential care extends to the minute detail of working in his family before he's even born. And the woman conceived and bore a son. Is that a given? Is a conception in a marriage a given? How many childless couples are there out there that are willing to pay anything they can get their hands on, all the money they got, to adopt a child because they can't conceive one naturally? That's not a given. That's a result of providential care. This conception, this birth, is a result of God's working in this family to produce this son. What makes it a son instead of a daughter? Depends on the chromosome of the first guy that gets there, isn't it? Yeah, that first male sperm that fertilizes the female egg, it depends on what chromosome number 23 is, whether that's a male or a female. And it can be either one because the male has two. 50-50 chance that it's a male versus a female, unless God controls the birth. Then it's a 100% chance that it is a male, which it is in this case. So God is at work behind the scenes, before he's even conceived, and as part of the conception process to bring about Moses' life. A lot of times when we're between a rock and a hard place, we think God doesn't even know we're alive, don't we? We don't see him manipulating the details that we are told here in our lives, and we think, man, he's forgot about me. This is bad stuff I'm going through. And we get discouraged and depressed. But keep in mind, as is Moses' case here, God is fully in control of every minute detail of our lives. So Moses is conceived, the third child in his family. And the mother saw him and she hid him for 3 months. I guess it was easy enough to keep him from the neighbors and everybody else. Anybody know he's alive for maybe 3 months, and then he gets big enough it's hard to do. Can't see him anymore. So she had to do something. Remember verse 22 of chapter 1, Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, every son is born you're to cast into the Nile. The daughters you can keep alive, but you're supposed to throw those male children into the Nile. What a guy. So she is supposed to chuck him in the river. But she didn't do that. Look what she did. She got him a wicker basket. You know what the name actually is for this wicker basket? It's an ark. Same word that Noah built. It is an ark. It is a place of protection for him. And she covered it over with some stuff that makes it float, some tar and some pitch. But same word as in Genesis 6:14, by the way. Then she put the child into it and set it among the reeds by the bank of the Nile. Now his mother must have had some reason to think that maybe this plan had a chance of working. Perhaps there was some populace that would come down to the Nile from time to time or something that might see the ark, might see the child and take it in and help it of Egyptian origin and so on. But she thinks this at least might help, might work, might keep him alive. And his sister stood at a distance to find out what would happen to him. So Miriam, who I think is probably about 15 or so, is watching what's going on here. Of course, Moses knows none of this is going on. He doesn't know anything about his parents, so he doesn't know anything about his sister watching over him. He doesn't know any of this. He's just an infant. But God is at work manipulating all of these details, all these circumstances. He's making Romans 8:28, all things work together for good. He's making that a reality in Moses' life. So she's kind of watching, checking it out. Then the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the Nile. Of all the people who's hitting the shower that time of day in that place includes Pharaoh's daughter. Apparently there was some kind of a bathing facility built there or something. I don't know. I guess it's a common thing. Maybe the mother knew that. Maybe she thought that perhaps someone from Pharaoh's entourage there, his daughter's entourage, would find him and find the basket. And she did. She's down there bathing with her maidens, walking alongside the Nile. And she saw the basket. Among all of the Egyptian population that could see this basket, it's Pharaoh's daughter who spots it. What a coincidence. And she has her maid bring it to her. And she opened it, verse 6, and she saw the child, And behold, the boy was crying, and she had pity on him and said, this is one of the Hebrews' children. Now, clearly, the daughter's perspective on life is not quite the same as her father's, is it? She opens this basket, and here is a Hebrew child, and she has pity on him. Her father said, throw him in the river. Let the alligators eat him. Crocodiles, whatever they are. But the daughter is cut from a little different piece of cloth than her father. She's tender-hearted. She's a decent human being, unlike him. What if a man had found him? Think he would have cared? Or another woman that wasn't tender-hearted or caring and didn't pity him might have thrown him in the river there too. So the right person at the right time, in the right place, with the right frame of mind, the right heart, happens to find Moses. And she recognized him as a Hebrew child. Perhaps he had some garments or something of that nature that identified him as a Hebrew. But she doesn't care. Remember, her father's trying to kill them all off, the boys. But she doesn't care. And then Miriam steps up to the plate, verse 7. She says, shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women that she may nurse the child for you? Now, this is a pretty sharp little cookie, isn't it? Either she's been coached by her mother or she's just very good on her feet. She sees a wonderful opportunity here to tie Moses and his mother back together. So either she has been instructed by her mother what to do, or she just simply is very sharp, and she does. She says, can I go get a nurse for you? You know who she's going to pick, don't you? Of course. Pharaoh's daughter responded, verse 8, and said, yeah, go ahead. So the girl went and called the child's mother. Boy, these coincidences are just blowing my mind here. They're piling up. I can't quite process all of them, that this many different coincidences would work out, that Moses' own mother nurses him for 2 or 3 years in this environment with this command from Pharaoh. He's still going to be in his own mother's arms until he's weaned. All things work together for good to those that love God, is our New Testament principle. And here you see how God manipulates them in great detail and in great extent to bring that about. So Pharaoh's daughter said, yeah, do that. Take this child away and nurse. Well, when her daughter came, take this child away and nurse him for me. I'll give you your wages. So not only does she get to nurse her own child, she gets a paycheck for nursing her own child. What a coincidence. So the woman took the child and nursed him, and the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter. He probably at age 2 or 3, long and through there, whenever he was weaned. And he became her son. Now, is this a childless woman? Probably. We're not told, but it would make sense that she didn't have a child. That's why she wanted this one. That's why she was willing to, in effect, adopt him. So is there some divine control and manipulation of the sort of the enemies of God's people here to where this lady, this Pharaoh's daughter, wants him as a child and is willing to adopt him and so on? Sure. And so she named him Moses because that name means to draw out of water, and that's what she did with him. So Moses' first 40 illustrates beautifully for us the principle of Romans 8:28, and God manipulating and controlling details of his life to save him from an early death, to put him exactly where he wanted him, and worked all of that out. And we're not told a whole lot more about his background there, but you can imagine, I think, that he is in effect in a most blessed situation there, a extremely privileged position in Egypt. It's kind of like he's got a Rhodes Scholar here to Rhodes Scholarship to his future, and he's going to be trained and taught in the ways of Egypt for the first 40 years of his life. He probably learned about administrating large numbers of people. Probably Moses was a very good administrator by the end of his first 40 years, working with the Egyptians and the Egyptian systems and the Egyptian economies and all that sort of stuff, so that he is probably now quite skilled in leading or administrating large number of people. Is that going to matter? Well, remember that when they come out of there, there's about 2 million of them. That's a large number of people, isn't it? He'd be like the leader of a large or small city, around 2 million people. So he's being trained and prepared in his first 40 for a leadership role that he is not quite ready to step into yet, but he's being prepared for it. So you see the illustration of the New Testament principle. All things work together for good to those that love God. Moses' life illustrates that principle. So does Joseph's life. So does any other life where we're given the detail that we are here, and in the case of Joseph, the background and all that sort of stuff. You can see it in those cases. Now, a lot of times we don't see that. We don't have this detail. But in this case, we do. So, a good illustration of what Romans 8:28 means to all of us. All things being manipulated by God. All right, second 40 year of Moses' life begins at verse 11 of chapter 2. And we're going to see another principle illustrated in this second 40. Let me read you a few New Testament passages, and you just kind of think about, well, what's the principle being sort of emphasized or stated in that passage? And we'll try to pull it all together here in just a moment. But just listen to these passages and see what you think. Hebrews 5, 12 through 13. For though by this time you ought to be teachers, you have need again for someone to teach you the elementary principles of the oracles of God. And you have come to need milk, not solid food. For everyone who partakes only of milk is not accustomed to the word of righteousness. He's an infant. 2 Peter 3:18. But grow in the grace and knowledge of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. To him be the glory both now and to the day of eternity. Amen. 1 Timothy 4:7. But have nothing to do with worldly fables fit only for old women. On the other hand, discipline yourself for the purpose of godliness. Ephesians 6, 13 through 17. Stand firm, therefore, having girded your loins with truth, and then he mentions all those other articles of military equipment. We'll come back to this. Colossians 4, 12. Epaphras, who is one of your number, a bondslave of Jesus Christ, sends you his greetings, always laboring earnestly for you in his prayers. Ephesians 4, 14 and 15, we are to grow up in all aspects into him who is the head, even Christ. Now let me repeat the emphasized part of these verses again for you. Think about this. By this time, grow in the grace and knowledge, discipline yourself, stand firm, always laboring earnestly, to grow up. See the trend in those verses? Does maturity happen overnight? Is it an instantaneous process, a result in our lives when we're born again? No, it isn't, is it? It's a process. It takes time to grow and to mature spiritually. It involves disciplining ourselves. It involves at times hard work. So that it takes time for God to prepare us for Christian service, doesn't it? Now, hopefully it doesn't take 40 years for everybody. Most of us would be dead and gone before we could get prepared, wouldn't we? But it took 40 years for Moses to be prepared. His second 40 is preparing him for the role that God has for him. The New Testament principle is it takes time to mature for God's service. That's illustrated in Moses' second 40. Okay? That's what we're going to be seeing here. It takes some time for that to happen. And we'll see the method that God used there. We'll see the circumstances that God used to prepare Moses for the task before him, because he's not ready at the end of his first 40. One would think maybe 40 years would be enough, wouldn't you, to get prepared? But he's not. We'll see the problem he has here as we go along. Okay, let's look at the second 40, illustrating the principle of it takes time to prepare God's children for his service, at beginning at verse 11 and going forward. So it came about in those days when Moses had grown up, he's 40 years old, he went out to his brethren and he looked on their hard labors. Remember, Pharaoh is trying to break these people through slavery, and he's working them to death as best he can. So he sees the Hebrews being abused by an Egyptian. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. When I thought Moses had spent the last 40 years being raised a life of privilege in the Egyptian court, as his daughter's adopted son, in effect Pharaoh's grandson. And he sees this conflict between a Hebrew and an Egyptian, and he identifies himself with which one? The Hebrew. Well, I'd ask you, well, why is that? He's been an Egyptian for 40 years. Clearly, his affinity is for his brethren, the Hebrews. That's a bit striking, isn't it? That after 40 years of benefiting from being an Egyptian, he identifies with the Hebrew. And they're in some sort of conflict. The Egyptian is beating the Hebrew guy. So Moses, verse 12, he looked this way and that. Why does he do that? Why does he look around to see if anybody sees him? Does he not know that there's going to be consequences to what he's about to do? And he wants to know if anybody's going to see those consequences, because if they do see those consequences and they see Moses do something to the Egyptian, there could be a high price to pay. So he looks around. He knows what he's about to do may not go over too well, huh? So he looks around, he checks it out. And what's he do? When he doesn't see anybody watching, he strikes down the Egyptian and buries him in the sand. Now, clearly, Moses' skill at conflict resolution needs a little honing here, doesn't it? He can't even break up a conflict between two people. He kills one of the two, the Egyptian. That look like he's prepared and ready to lead 2 million of God's children out of Egypt to a good place? When he can't even resolve a conflict between two guys? He isn't ready. He needs the second 40. The first 40 has not gotten him ready for the job. So he intervenes, and Stephen in Acts chapter 7 refers to Moses as being mighty in being powerful in word and deed. I take it he was a pretty good-sized guy. This ain't Casper Milquetoast here. He kills this Egyptian, a slave master, with his own bare hands. And that slave master was probably not no wimp himself. And Moses kills this guy. This is what we call in our legal system today a case of first-degree murder. He looked around, thought through what he was going to do, and then he killed the guy. He became what we would call a first-degree murderer in our legal system today. Not quite ready to lead and judge the nation Israel yet with that kind of an attitude, is he? But he did it and illustrates why there's a second 40 here. So he goes out the next day, and behold, he sees two Hebrews fighting with each other. Not only did they have the problem of contending with Pharaoh's abuses from the Egyptians, they're fighting among themselves. They can't even get along well enough to not be fighting themselves. So he sees these two Hebrews, and he kind of intervenes again, kind of steps up and says to the offender, "Why are you striking your companion?" The guy just can't seem to walk away from the situation, can he? Intervenes, sticks his nose into situations that maybe he'll walk away from. "Why are you striking your companion?" And he said, the companion said, or the other guy said, "Who made you a prince or judge over us? Are you intending to kill me as you killed the Egyptians?" Well, when he looked both ways and he didn't see anybody, obviously the guy that he saved saw what he did. He saw that Moses killed that Egyptian and buried him in the sand, and apparently he couldn't keep his mouth shut. He ratted out Moses, and it is known then to this guy and probably others what Moses did. So he was afraid, and he said, "Whoops, surely the matter has become known." So that looking both ways, that didn't pay off for him. People know what he did. People know that Moses sided with his own people and killed an Egyptian to resolve the conflict. So Pharaoh hears about this somehow. People just can't keep their mouths shut about anything, can they? People are blabbing about this, and Pharaoh hears of it. Look at his response. He tried to kill Moses. Obviously, the relationship between Granddad, Pharaoh, and Moses here ain't too good. It doesn't say Pharaoh went out and gathered facts to understand what went on here and sat him down and talked to him or tried to understand the situation anyway. He just immediately jumps to the extreme and says, "I'm going to kill that guy." He clearly has sided with my enemies, even though he's my daughter's adopted son. I don't care. I'm going to kill the guy. And so that's his reaction. Clearly something has soured those two relative to each other over the years, hasn't he? He doesn't have any grandfatherly love for Moses. We don't know the background to all of that. Maybe the daughter has passed on. Maybe she's not alive anymore, so that buffer is not there. And maybe there's been some other conflict throughout the years that led Pharaoh to think that maybe Moses was a traitor of sorts. I don't know what the background is, but clearly Moses has no love for, Pharaoh has no love for Moses, or vice versa for that matter. So he says, I'm going to pay this guy back. I'm going to kill him. And somehow or another, Moses hears of that and he knows about that. So he hits the road. Verse 15, he fled from the presence of Pharaoh and settled in the land of Midian. And he sat down by a well. You've got this, a copy of this map in your handout, which shows where the land of Midian is. It's a little bright, but can you see that red dot right there? This side of the Gulf of Aqaba is called the land of Midian on most maps. But most of the people think that they actually occupied both sides of that gulf. So that they're over here on this side as well as this side. So he's left up here, and instead of going the northern route up here, he's come down south in the Sinai Peninsula, and he's probably around here somewhere. Now, the reason he probably didn't go north is that the Egyptians would keep, they had outposts up here on the northern edge. Up in this region up here, they had outposts to be able to detect any military activity might come against them from up in that general region. So he probably knows that there's Egyptians up here. So he heads south and comes down here. So he's somewhere down here in fleeing from Pharaoh, figuring that probably safer to get down there, I think, than up north. So that's probably why he's down there. Clearly, God is still superintending his life and bringing him to the exact spot he wants him at, right down here somewhere, sitting at a well. A well. There's more than one well in that region of the world, but he's sitting by a well that God wanted him to sit at. So we're continuing to see the providential care of him, even in the second 40. So here he is, I don't know how many days' journey away, maybe a week or so, and he has sat down by this one particular well. And there was a guy in that region known as the priest of Midian. Now, Midian was one of Abraham's sons by Keturah. Genesis 25:1 lists the names of his six sons that he had via her. So he had a total of eight sons. You know about Ishmael and Isaac, but you don't usually hear about these other six. One of them was this guy, Midian, and he settled down there in that area, and he's acting as a priest for his people down in that area there. Okay, so he's working down in this area down here. What kind of a priest is this guy? I don't know. There is no Mosaic priesthood yet. So he's not a priest in the sense that he represents God and the Mosaic law to God's people. That ain't going on because there is no Mosaic law yet. Is he a priest like Melchizedek? Well, Melchizedek was a king priest. He was a twofer. And there's no indication here that he is a king of that area. It just says he's just a priest. So we don't know for certain. Is he ministering to the Midianites based upon the Midianite religion? And what is that? We don't know. Or has he actually been instructed by God in some way to sort of intervene and to represent God to the peoples of that region? We don't know. Remember, Job did that. Job acted sort of as a family priest to his family. Maybe he's like that. I don't know. But somehow or another, he is in that capacity. So he's mentioned here to us because he plays a role in Moses' life. And he's got seven daughters. Apparently no sons. Remember that 50-50 chance I talked to you about earlier about whether a fertilized egg is male or female? He's 0 for 7. His 50-50 didn't work out. Clearly, God has controlled his all things also, hasn't he? He's got all daughters. And they're shepherdesses. What else are they going to be out there in a desert environment? Not the only way to make a living was shepherding sheep. And if you got no sons, you make tomboys out of your daughters and send them out there to shepherd the sheep. So this guy's 7 daughters are working the sheep, and they came to draw water at this well and fill their troughs to water their father's flock. What would happen in these regions is that you'd have sort of a communal well here, a community well. All of the different herds would use the same well. They would usually wait to a certain time of the day, afternoon, late afternoon, and they'd roll a big stone off the top of the well, and then everybody would get their water out and everybody would water their flocks. So it's usually a one time a day, all of the flocks in the region would be watered. Well, on this particular day, the girls came early. And what happens? The mean old bully shepherd boys in the area, they start bugging the girls and ran them off. They're just being bullied. The girl shepherds are just being bullied by the men shepherds in the area there where Moses sat down to rest. So he sees another instance of conflict, doesn't he? This time between bullying males and these 7 daughters of this Midian priest. But Moses gets involved, verse 17, and stood up and helped the girls. He intervenes this time, not between an Egyptian and a Hebrew or between two Hebrews, but between female shepherds being bullied by male shepherds, and he steps in the fray. And as I say, he must have been a pretty good-sized guy because he runs off all of these male shepherds and helps these girls. He stood up and drove them away. I guess we got to give it to the guy that he doesn't like social injustice when he sees it. And he either kills it or he runs it off, whatever the case may be here. So of all of the wells in all of the world where he would flee to from Pharaoh's presence, he ends up at this well where these girls come early on this day and are being bullied by the local men. And he intervenes on their behalf. That sticks his foot in a door. The door is Jethro, whose name we haven't seen yet. It's actually Reuel early on, verse 18. The girls go home and tell their fathers what's happened here. He says, what are you guys doing back here so early today? And they say, well, an Egyptian delivered us from the hand of the shepherds. Clearly, Moses is still looking like an Egyptian. He's got on some garb. Maybe he combs his hair like an Egyptian. Whatever. They see and recognize him as an Egyptian. And they tell their father, hey, this guy helped us. And so the father says, verse 20, well, where is he then? Why is it that you've left the man behind? Invite him to have something to eat. So this guy, we'll call him Jethro. His name changes here from Jewel to Jethro, Reuel to Jethro. This guy then invites Moses into his home because he helped his daughters. And this is going to establish now a home environment for Moses for the next 40 years. One well in this place, at this time of day gets him drawn to a family relationship that will go for the next 40 years. And Moses was willing to do that. He was willing to dwell with the man. And so Jethro gave him a daughter in marriage. Her name is Zipporah. I guess is how you pronounce that, Zipporah. And he had some children by her there in that home. She gave birth to a son named Gershon, where he said, I've been a sojourner in a foreign land. Now we will see God work through at least three different aspects of Moses' life during this next 40 here that began with this incident at this well. We'll see God manipulate his living circumstances to prepare him. Those involve learning this terrain. He's going to be a shepherd, and he's going to learn how to function in a desert environment. You think he knew how to do that when he first got there? Being brought up in Egyptian home of privilege and ease and luxury? Now, I don't think he knew anything about shepherding. Egyptians hated shepherds, by the way. He wouldn't have been doing any of it in Egypt. So he's learning altogether a new perspective on life via his living circumstances. How to function well in a desert environment. Is that going to matter? Where is he going to lead those 2 million people out of Egypt? In a desert environment. So he's getting some OJT on how to function in leadership for them when they come out of there. Second area of his life that God is working through is his family circumstances. He was probably a playboy-like type in Egypt. He didn't have any familial responsibilities. But here he's going to have. He's going to have to learn how to function as a husband and a father, to lead a household, to care for and be responsible for the well-being of people, which would be, I think, new to him also from his Egyptian background. And thirdly, God is going to work through his work circumstances. He's going to be a shepherd. He's going to take an entry-level job here at the beginning of his 40 years of working for his father-in-law. And at the end of those 40 years, he's still in that entry-level job working for his father-in-law. He doesn't make any progress at all. He has no herds of his own. He's learned a very humbling lifestyle by working for somebody else for 40 years. Remember, even Jacob made a bunch of money off of his father-in-law, good old uncle Laban. Moses doesn't. We see him in the same basic work environment role at the end of 40 years as we see him at the beginning of it. But it's this 40 years and these circumstances of his life that do prepare him for the role that God has for him here. The first 40 gives us his origin and his initial training and learning in the Egyptian court. The second 40 prepares him for the leadership role that God wants him to use in bringing the children of Israel out of there, and we'll see that. So it came about in the course of those many days, 40 years, that the king of Egypt died, and the sons of Israel sighed because of the bondage, and they cried out. And their cry for help was because of their bondage that rose up before God. And God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And God saw the sons of Israel, and he took notice of them. Situation looks pretty hopeless, doesn't it? They're enslaved. There's no leader there. They can't deliver themselves because the power of the Egyptians is too great for them. They're a hopeless people, aren't they? We have an expression we use oftentimes in our lives that we don't have a prayer. There's no hope. But the truth of the matter is that as believers, as the redeemed of God in the New Testament era, we never are without hope. The writer to the Hebrews mentions in his book that hope is the anchor of our soul. It is something to which we can cling to and never lose sight of. The anchor of our soul is hope. So we never lose that. We always have that, and these people have that even though it looks like perhaps they don't. Things look very desperate to them. So their prayers have gone up to God, and He has heard them, and He took notice of them. We are never without hope, and theirs is about to be met as we continue on through this book. All right, let's throttle back a little bit now and kind of review what we've seen here this morning. We're seeing the preparation of God's deliverer. The first 40 years of his life was spent in Egyptian luxury, learning the ways of the Egyptians, perhaps learning various aspects of administration and things of that sort that will come in handy for him as he leads the people out of there. The second 40 years of his life was spent in a desert, in a very humbling set of circumstances, shepherding sheep, but learning the terrain of the desert, learning how to function there, learning how to find water, learning how to take care of herds of sheep, and doing the things that will actually be relevant to his work in delivering the children of Israel out of Egypt. So at the end of that second 40, he's much more prepared and ready to fulfill that role than he was at the end of the first 40. Now, does it have to take 80 years to get a guy ready? No, not usually. His preparation is different than most. It's longer than most. But it's what God put him through to get him uniquely qualified with his familiarity with the Egyptian culture and functioning of government and the leading of people through a desert environment for a long period of time. So he will be kind of eminently qualified when God does call him, which he'll do next week. He won't call him until then. We'll see that next time. Any questions or comments about anything we saw here today? Bill?
Why do you think the Egyptians hated the arrangement? You said it a while ago that you thought the Egyptians
hated the shepherds.
Yeah.
Bill's question is, why do the Egyptians hate the shepherds? They just thought it was a low-life occupation and bad thing to do. Remember when Jacob first went down there, Joseph counseled him and said, look, tell them you're ranchers. Don't tell them you're shepherds. They don't like shepherds. They don't like sheep. Sheep are dirty, worthless critters, and the people that tend to them are the same way. So they just didn't like them. So there's a history there of dislike between the Egyptian culture and the shepherding of sheep. Carol.
Don't you feel like Moses continued a relationship with his Hebrew family? I mean, Miriam and Aaron and his mother and father, which gave him a heart for his own people?
Carol's question is, did Moses carry on a familial relationship with the Hebrews and his Hebrew family that kind of maybe explains some of this reaction? I just don't know. We're just not told if Miriam or Aaron came around. Now, he knows Aaron, so he must know something. Did he associate with them? Possibly. Maybe that explains what appears to be sort of some animosity between Pharaoh and Moses. Maybe Pharaoh picked up on that right away and saw that Moses was siding with the Hebrews early on in his life. I don't know, that may be. But all we can do is guess there because we're not told. But it certainly could be. He has a good relationship with Aaron. Yeah. So that could be, and that could be part of the explanation for why Pharaoh jumped to the conclusion, trying to kill him at the first offense here. Any other questions or comments? Janelle.
I know we're talking about Moses, but I'm impressed with Moses' mother's courage and faith. First of all, she puts him in the river where the crocodile's there. She nurses him for 3 years and then gives him up again. Mm-hmm. You know, that was just... So he had good roots.
Yeah. Janelle is commenting on the faith displayed by Moses' mother in that she put him in the ark and believed that something good would happen and that he would be taken care of. I suspect that is absolutely true. I think Moses probably came from some very good stock. And that might explain a little bit of his familial relationship. She might have come around later and made some things known to him and so on and so forth. Just don't know. We don't have much insight into that detail. Yeah, Ken.
Seems like to me we're at the intermission of a wonderful movie that's better than Hollywood.
Yeah, really is. Even Charlton Heston can't play this role that well, can he? He tried, but he ain't that good either. All right, any other questions? Okay, I'll fire you out a copy of the roster, and you tell me if it ain't right. I'll email it to you, and we'll get everybody on it. I think we'll have it where we can get a hold of you and all that sort of stuff right away. We will see you next Thursday, Lord willing. Keep your space getting out of here, and be careful, be safe. Do what you can to help yourself, and we'll see you next Thursday, Lord willing. You bet.